In a small German town in the year 1828, a coach from Berlin stopped at an inn to change horses. As the passengers waited, they became impatient, for although the horses were ready, the coach had failed to reappear. All of a sudden, an 18-year-old passenger spied a piano in the corner and sat down to try out the keys. The piano was in good tune. He began to play, softly at first, then with more feeling, unaware the entire room was listening, transfixed. Even people from the town had appeared, drawn by the subtle beauty of his music. When the coachman finally appeared and announced it was time to go, a chorus of loud "No's" rose from the audience. At this point, the innkeeper interfered. "Let the coach go," he said. "If the young man will play on, I'll see that the fastest team in the village carries you to your destination." So the young man played on. And when he finally left, the villagers filled his carriage with fruits and delicacies for his long journey home to Poland. Such was the magical effect of the music of Frédéric Chopin. Chopin was born in a village near Warsaw, Poland, on March 1, 1810. Although he moved from Poland when he was still a young man, in many ways he never left it. He was Polish in outlook and temperament, and even in his music. Much of his work, the waltzes, mazurkas, and polonaises, reflect the folk sounds of his homeland. Chopin's father was a private tutor to the sons and daughters of the nobility, so Frédéric was born to simple parents on the estate of an aristocratic family. In his heart, it was the peasants he admired and linked with. Some of Chopin's greatest musical works were based on the songs and dances peasants performed at the parties of the wealthy. When Frédéric was still a baby, his parents moved to the bustling city of Warsaw so his father could make more money teaching in schools. In Warsaw, two more babies were born in 2 years, Frederick's sisters Isabella and Amelia. Every night the family would gather around the piano while Chopin's mother played the mazurkas she'd known from childhood. The family also liked to perform skits and plays for each other. As a child, Chopin was known for his wonderful skill at mimicry. He could imitate to perfection practically anyone he met. More astounding still was his sensitivity to music. It affected him so deeply that he would often sit and weep while his mother played an especially haunting melody. His own playing started as a toddler, when he would climb up on the piano bench and simply tinker away at the keys. His first teacher was his older sister, Louisa, who was all of 7 years old herself. Chopin was always close to all three of his sisters and enjoyed ice skating and even playing dolls with them. Later, he started a journal with them called Literary Amusement Association, which was full of amusing anecdotes about daily events. By the time he was 6, he was playing simple original melodies. The piano was so dear to him that at age 7, his parents allowed him to start formal lessons. The teacher to whom they entrusted this future genius was an eccentric fellow with no real system or method to his lessons, which couldn't have been better for Chopin. The teacher's name was Zwini. Zwini wasn't interested in the usual repetitious and tedious lessons that most students were made to suffer through. Instead, his lessons were more like social get-togethers between friends. He and Chopin would sit side by side, playing with the keys, talking and laughing, and discovering the music amidst their camaraderie. They shared so much fun together that they remained friends for many years after the lessons had ceased. Zwini was an open-minded musician who appreciated both the traditional music of Mozart and Beethoven and of the most modern composers. He gave Chopin a tremendous gift by encouraging his freedom and expansiveness. As a result of this early training, Chopin had little notion of what was not allowed, and therefore was always free to be inventive. Meanwhile, he amazed his teacher with the incredible flexibility of his wrists and the agility of his fingers. It didn't take long for the world to take notice. Chopin's first composition was printed when he was 7. Only a year later, he was playing piano at private parties. Then he was invited to perform at a charity concert where, decked out in a velvet suit with a broad lace collar, he played a difficult concerto that had the audience applauding wildly. When his mother, who hadn't been present, later asked him what the audience had enjoyed most, he responded, "My collar, Mama." After these early years, Chopin found, to his dismay, that the piano had to take second place while he finished his broader education. Until then, he'd been tutored at home by his father, which left him plenty of free time to become absorbed in his music. But at 13, his parents enrolled Chopin in school, and suddenly such unfriendly subjects as Latin took precedence in his life. He managed to do pretty well in Latin, but it was a different story with spelling. Chopin was a dismal speller his entire life. Once the schoolwork was proceeding, Chopin again started piano lessons, this time with a very different man from Zwini. His new teacher, Joseph Elsner, was a renowned conductor and composer who was much stricter and saw to it that Chopin learned the rules of harmony and counterpoint. At the same time, he never discouraged the natural romantic flair he saw in his student, which he recognized early on was a sign of unique talent. Now Chopin's life began to blossom in all kinds of directions. He took his classes at school, studied with Elsner, and joined in the vital social life of Warsaw. Frequently, he was asked to perform at receptions and balls, where he usually played the polonaise, the traditional stately dance of the upper class. All of this began to take its toll, however. Chopin was always delicate, and his busy schedule was beginning to affect his health. To recuperate, he spent his summers and holidays at the country estates of his friends. It was there in the country that he came to be an expert on Polish folk music, and especially the mazurka, ancient music that predated the discovery of scales and chords. All of this, along with the polonaise, became part of his ever-broadening repertoire. The year he turned 15 was a memorable year for Chopin, marked by three great achievements. The first one was a concert he gave as part of a celebration for a visit by the Russian Tsar Alexander I. The Tsar was so impressed with Chopin's performance that he presented him with a diamond ring. Soon after, Chopin was appointed the organist for the Lyceum, the most respected school in Poland, and the one which he was currently attending. But most importantly, that same year, Opus 1, his first official work, was published. Just as his star seemed to be rising, however, Chopin's health collapsed. His parents rushed him off to a spa, where they hoped the fresh air, mineral waters, and long hours of sleep would get him back on his feet. Throughout his brief life, Chopin had to struggle against physical weakness and illness that often made it hard for him to complete his work. As the demands and pressures on him increased, he became more and more fragile. Even at the spa, Chopin couldn't resist two invitations to perform at charity concerts for the benefit of orphans. Nevertheless, he emerged from his break the following autumn, refreshed and revitalized, a graduate from the Lyceum, and ready to do what he'd always wanted to do, devote himself full-time to music. He joined the Warsaw Conservatory of Music, which his teacher Elsner had founded, and threw himself into his lessons with a vigor he never could have found for Latin. Almost as quickly as he was shown new musical skills and techniques, he became a master at them. The only blight on these years was the death of his younger sister, Emilia, from consumption or tuberculosis, the disease that would eventually take his own life. The Chopins were an extremely close family, and the loss of Emilia devastated each one of them, Frederick included. By the time he was 19, Chopin was growing restless in Poland and wanted to visit the great musical capitals of the world, Vienna, Paris, Berlin and Rome. Denied a government grant, his parents began to desperately save and sacrifice so they could finance a grand tour. Meanwhile, Chopin met a music publisher who agreed to print his works if he would advertise it by playing public concerts. Chopin accepted and was a triumph. the composer Robert Schumann wrote of him, "Hats off, gentlemen, a genius." With his fame on the rise, it seemed the perfect time to launch his career around Europe. By now, money was no longer an obstacle, for his parents had saved enough. But a new obstacle arose, Chopin himself. There were two reasons Chopin suddenly found himself unwilling to leave Poland. One was that he had fallen in love with Constancia Gladkowska, a singing student at the conservatory. Because of the influence of her singing, he had taken an interest in Italian opera, and because of the influence of love, he was writing his first nocturnes and piano concertos. The other obstacle in his way was his own intuition. He had an eerie sense that, in his own words, "When I leave, it will be to forget home forever. I feel that I am leaving home only to die." Finally, he agreed to go, only because a friend said he would accompany him. Chopin left Poland when he was 20 years old, and as his coach passed through his hometown on its way to Vienna, a choir directed by his teacher Elsner assembled to sing him farewell. As they sang the last lines, "And so from the bottom of our hearts we say good luck wherever you go," Chopin headed out from his beloved homeland, which, true to his vision, he would never see again. He took with him a silver cup filled with Polish dirt. Chopin had been in Vienna only a short time when the news reached him that Poland had revolted against its Russian rulers and was at war. His traveling companion immediately rushed back home, leaving Chopin in a state of lonely anguish, worrying constantly about his young friends being killed and the deprivation of his family. He was not in the least political. He seldom read and seemed, if anything, removed from the world. But he cared deeply about his family. His parents wrote, pleading with him not to return because conditions were so difficult. Although he gave in to their wishes, Chopin found he couldn't stay in Vienna either. Anti-Polish sentiments were too strong and too disturbing. Instead, he moved on to Munich, where he gave a successful concert, and then on to Stuttgart, where he heard that the Poles had been defeated. Now even more worried about his friends and family, he crossed into France, which would remain his refuge until he died. If there was ever a perfect match between city and man, it was the one between Paris and Chopin. He took an apartment that overlooked the city and wrote home about its splendor and filthiness and virtue and vice. Almost immediately, he found a place in Parisian society. He was introduced to the conductor of the court theater. He joined a circle of friends his own age who would all make musical history in their own right. Liszt, Berlioz, Mendelssohn, and Schumann. German composers sent him invitations to visit them in Germany. In addition, many aristocratic Poles fled after the unsuccessful revolt and formed their own community in Paris, so that Chopin never felt too lonely for his homeland. From Paris, he undertook several concert tours of Germany and Britain. Before every concert, he practiced by playing Bach, who, along with Mozart, was his musical idol. To other composers, he was mainly indifferent. Everywhere Chopin went, people, and especially women, were captivated by his delicate good looks and charming manners, and of course, his virtuoso playing. He wrote home, "My manner of playing pleases the ladies so much." Sometimes he liked to play practical jokes on his adoring audience. His favorite was to lull people almost to sleep with soft, delicate playing, and then wake them up with a bang. Someone who saw Chopin once said that he looked like his music. He was pale and handsome, with black silky locks that dangled across his forehead. His nose was prominent, although not huge as he claimed it was, and he had round eyes and a small, sweet smile. "He is no man," wrote one friend. "He is a god." Chopin was very refined, and he never swore, although he sometimes revealed a malicious wit. Like most artists, he could be very temperamental, and his feelings were so sensitive that he could spend an entire day sulking. His social life in Paris established, Chopin now had to turn to his career, which demanded some critical decisions. It was Chopin's dream to be a professional performer, but he was being encouraged instead by Elsner to compose. Elsner's view was backed up by recent reviews of his performances, which indicated his music was too delicate and personal to carry in large concert halls. Finally, Chopin decided to abandon his study of piano and to limit his performances to smaller, private parties, where his music could connect more fully with the audience. Sometimes he would relieve the serious mood of his intimate concerts by breaking into imitations. He never lost the mimicking abilities he had as a child, and some of his friends thought he would do even better in theater than as a piano player. Theater was indeed his second love, and he never missed an opening night. The private concerts worked from a creative standpoint, but not from a financial one. Even though he had once proclaimed, "I'm a revolutionary. Money means nothing to me." If he wanted to survive, he would somehow have to increase his income. The opportunity came when a friend introduced him to the Rothschilds, one of the wealthiest banking families in Europe. They hired him as a piano instructor, which inspired other influential families to do the same, until soon he became the most sought-after teacher in Paris. Since Chopin believed a true gentleman never touched money, he would ask his employers to leave their payment on the mantel while he looked out the window. Meanwhile, publishers in Germany, England, and France were printing his compositions, both old and new. Soon Chopin had so much money he was able not only to live in luxury, but to repay his family for all the sacrifices it had made to help him succeed. He had a servant, a horse and carriage, and the finest clothes from the best shops in Paris. His preferences were blue velvet coats, silk shirts, diamond stick pins, white leather gloves, and a flowing black cloak lined with gray satin. His handkerchiefs were perfumed, and his rooms were always adorned with vases of fresh violets. Soon it became trendy among the Parisian aristocrats to have Chopin for dinner, and always, of course, they imposed on him to play afterwards. Although he knew he was being taken advantage of, Chopin usually obliged. One evening, however, when a hostess almost demanded that he play after dinner, he pointed out the unfairness of her expectation by murmuring, "But, madam, I have eaten so little." When he was 26, Chopin fell in love again, this time with the 16-year-old daughter of friends, who was an accomplished pianist herself. They spent an entire summer together, and as a farewell gift, he wrote her a waltz entitled La Valse de l'Adieu, the Goodbye Waltz. The farewell was meant to be temporary. His real intention was to marry the girl. Unfortunately, her parents, although they liked Chopin, were concerned about his health. That concern intensified the next winter, when Chopin suffered another bout of illness and spent the entire season convalescing. From then on, communications from the girl's family ceased. As Chopin grew older, he only seemed to grow more delicate and sensitive. He could drink only milk, never wine or coffee, and ate only certain foods, bread, pastries, chicken, and fish. His entire life he never weighed more than 100 pounds. Strong smells made him ill, too, especially tobacco. His sensitivity to odors caused a problem once with a friend who borrowed a copy of his manuscript for the concerto in E minor. Knowing how fussy Chopin was about the appearance of his manuscripts, the friend used white gloves to turn the pages. He returned it without a spot or mark on it. But on opening it, Chopin grimaced unhappily. "My dear fellow," he said, "you were smoking when you read it." He had similar problems with noises and sudden surprises, which rattled him so much that his hair stood on end. As chronically ill people often do, he became fastidious in his habits and somewhat superstitious. He couldn't sleep unless his slippers were lined up beside his bed. He insisted on entering a room always with the right foot first. He also had a terror of being buried alive and even asked on his deathbed that he be cut open before they buried him. When his hopes of marriage were dashed, Chopin bundled up all his letters from the girl, tied it with a string, and wrote on it in Polish, "Moja bieda," my misery. It was perhaps because of his misery that he failed to recognize his true love when she wandered into his life a few months later. In fact, upon meeting her, he wrote home to his family that he didn't like her face. He was not alone in his distaste for the woman, for half of Paris felt the same way. The other half adored her. Her name was Aurora Dupin, but she is famous today, as she was then, as George Sand, the daring and unconventional novelist who was perhaps the most notorious person in Paris. Even the sophisticated Parisians were shocked when she took her two children and abandoned her dull and provincial husband to pursue her own free lifestyle. She shocked them even more with her uninhibited writing, her numerous love affairs, her habit of gadding about in men's clothing and smoking cigars, and her penchant for mountain climbing. George Sand was not a woman who hesitated to live exactly as she wanted, and now she had decided she wanted to live with Frédéric Chopin. Sand forthrightly proposed to Chopin that she become his mistress. Even though he was becoming more and more attracted to her, he resisted. He was terrified of becoming the subject of gossip or of disappointing his parents. Sand was as eloquent in person as in print, however, and she soon convinced him that conventional morality shouldn't rule matters of the heart. So, with her two children in tow, they snuck away to the Mediterranean island of Majorca, off the Spanish coast. At first, island life seemed to do wonders for Chopin's health. Ecstatic, he wrote to a Polish friend, "Here I am among palms, cedar, cacti, olive trees, oranges, lemons, aloes, figs, pomegranates. The sky is like turquoise, the sea like lapis lazuli, the mountains like emerald, and the air is in heaven. In the daytime, sunshine. At night, guitars and songs for hours on end. In a word, life is marvelous. I am close to all that is most beautiful. I am a better man." But then he took a hike with Sand and the children and was caught in a fierce rainstorm. Within 2 days, his cough was so severe that doctors had to be summoned. Sand moved him out of the damp house they'd rented into a nearby monastery, which she filled with rugs and cushions to make it more comfortable. All that winter it rained, and Chopin grew weaker and weaker. Still, he worked, trying to finish the 24 preludes he'd promised a publisher before leaving Paris. Day and night, his body was racked by steady coughing. Sand, although allegedly working on her latest novel, attended to Chopin every minute. Finally, she made arrangements to move him to Marseille. By the time they arrived, Chopin had suffered a lung hemorrhage, and it took the full-time efforts of both Sand and a crew of doctors to nurse him back to health. Once well, he wrote some of the strongest music he ever created, partly inspired by his near-death experience on Majorca. It was the B-flat minor sonata, also named the Funeral March Sonata. When Chopin was recovered, the couple returned to Paris, where he continued to teach and to perform at private parties and the court of King Louis. Yet by the end of every working day, he was in a state of deep exhaustion. He and San lived in houses next door to each other, to assure the creative privacy of each and to protect themselves from scandal. Ideas for compositions came to Chopin quickly, usually while he was playing the piano or out walking. He would lock himself in his room for days at a time, suffering through the creative process like a madman, pacing the floor, weeping, and breaking pens. Sometimes he would work for 6 weeks on one single page of music, and frequently he arose and worked in the middle of the night. Sand said of these productive times, "He does not know on what planet he exists." Sand dedicated herself full-heartedly to keeping him alive and helping him in his work. Her nicknames for him were "My Little Complainer" and "My Dear Corpse." Every summer she took him to her beautiful country house at Noant, where he wrote some of his greatest music. They ate outdoors, visited with friends, and at twilight every day he played for her. George Sand's devotion to Chopin verged on saintliness, but though his health and work thrived on it, their relationship did not. As Sand's role became more that of a mother and less a lover, Chopin became convinced she was in love with another man. His suspicions were false, but Sand couldn't convince him otherwise. Matters were made even worse when Sand released her newest novel, a story about a delicate, handsome man whose jealousy killed the woman he loved. Sand insisted the book wasn't based on Chopin, but the similarities were so striking that no one believed her. Things were already at a crisis when Sand's 18-year-old daughter, Solange, pushed them to a breaking point. She married a penniless, egotistical sculptor, and then the newlyweds moved in with Sand at the house in Noant. She supported them financially for a while, but when Solange's husband became more demanding and threw violent temper tantrums, she ordered them out of the house. Chopin was in Paris at the time, unaware of the frictions between mother and daughter. So when Solange rushed to him for money, he gladly obliged her. Sand interpreted this as a personal insult and believed he had deliberately taken the side of her daughter against her. Because of this tragic misunderstanding, Chopin and Sand never wrote or spoke to each other again. A few years later, they were both attending a Parisian social event and met on a stairway. They paused and gazed at each other, but neither spoke. She continued up the stairway, and he continued down. Yet each had revealed to their friends many times how much they wanted to be reunited. In the end, neither could overcome their pride. Chopin kept a lock of her hair in his diary until the day he died. With the loss of George Sand, Chopin found himself, at the age of 38, truly alone for the first time in his life. Around the same time, his career began to suffer. Revolution broke out in France, and wealthy families that had once hired him to perform or teach now found themselves tightening their purse strings. For a while, Chopin wandered around Scotland and England, staying with people who were proud to have the famous but poor musician as their house guest. But the damp weather of Britain was bad for his health, so he soon returned to Paris. There, he worried most about the fact that his inspiration had deserted him. Ideas for compositions came sporadically and were difficult to complete. Chopin's health was so bad now that his friends called in every doctor they could find to try and help him. None of them could. Wrote Chopin to a friend, "They all agree about climate, quiet, rest, rest. I shall have that one day without their help." For months now, Chopin's valet had been carrying him up the stairs to his room at night, so weak was he. He summoned up the strength to teach a few piano lessons and compose some minor mazurkas, and never knew that friends were secretly helping to pay his bills. Although he tried to keep his difficulties hidden from his family, his mother somehow found out and sent him 2,000 francs. She may have suspected something was wrong when he began to fervently request that his older sister, Louise, come and visit. While Louise was visiting, George Sand wrote to her and asked for help in arranging a reconciliation with Chopin. Louise destroyed the letter and never told him. Although his family and friends had rallied forth to support Chopin in his most difficult time, none of them could prevent the deadly course of tuberculosis. By fall of 1849, Chopin was too weak to rise from bed. He was calm and brave in the face of death and asked his friends to destroy any incomplete manuscripts. On October 17th, he received the Holy Sacraments and spoke his last words, "Play Mozart in memory of me." Then he was gone at the age of only 38. As he had requested, Mozart's Requiem was played at Chopin's funeral, along with his own funeral march. the singer who sang at his memorial service was the same one who had sung at Beethoven's and Haydn's. Chopin was buried in Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, where many famous artists and musicians have been so honored. A year later, a monument was erected over his grave of a weeping muse with a broken lyre. During the dedication ceremony, a handful of Polish soil was sprinkled over the grave. It is said that ever since, not a day passes without someone putting fresh flowers on his grave. Frédéric Chopin was one of the greatest pianists in history. His small, delicate hands, which Sand called velvet fingers, tended to play softly but with amazing dexterity. His feet, too, were in constant motion, and he was so rapid on the pedals that to the audience it appeared his legs were vibrating. But the gift Chopin gave to the piano for posterity was his posing. In his work, he established the piano as a solo instrument, free from chorus or orchestra. Almost all of his greatest works were written for piano alone. The music of Chopin is known for being romantic but not sentimental, subtle but emotional. He is called the poet of music because he revealed his most inner self in his work. Chopin's specialty was to take passionate feelings and transform them into short, elegant compositions that were fresh and completely original. He raised the modest mazurka and ballroom waltz to a new level of artistry. His preludes and nocturnes, pieces that evoke the romantic beauty of night, show his lyrical talents, while his mazurkas and polonaises express his love for his native land of Poland. Chopin is one of the few famous composers whose work have never gone in and out of style. He has been steadily popular ever since his own time. One of his most recognizable and whimsical pieces is the famous Waltz in D-flat, more commonly known as the Minute Waltz, for the simple reason that it can be played in 1 minute. Chopin wrote it for George Sand's dog. Besides this tribute to his lover's dog, Chopin also wrote a piece called The Cat Waltz, supposedly inspired by the notes that rang out one day when his cat jumped up on the keyboard. On a far more somber note is Chopin's Funeral March, one of the most famous funeral compositions ever written. He composed it after his first tryst with George Sand on the island of Majorca, where he had come so close to death. Thank you. jealous is the work of Chopin that many of his melodies were given lyrics and gained popularity as modern songs. One of those was Till the End of Time, which was the theme for a movie on his life. Another that many people don't realize is a Chopin tune is the song I'm Always Chasing Rainbows. Chopin himself very rarely gave his works titles. They're simply numbered, like Opus 1, or identified by form and key, such as Concerto in E minor or Sonata in B flat. But we can usually recognize a piece anyway, if it is emotional, but classical and not sentimental, if it is ethereal and delicate, if it comes from deep within the heart, then it is Chopin.
This is the end of the session.